We'll move now to case number two, Christine Dantzel versus Groupon, Inc., appeal number 19-1831 for the appellant. We'll go to Mr. Tomasin.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Ben Tomasin, and I'm here today representing Ms. Christine Dantzel. Your Honors, there are two main issues flagged in this Rule 23F petition. One is jurisdictional, and then the other concerns the substance of the district court's order denying class certification. I'll jump right into the jurisdictional issue. Your Honors, this case was filed in 2016 in Illinois State Court. At that time, Ms. Dantzel alleged a class of folks affected by Groupon's conduct and limited her class to Illinois residents. There were no allegations in the complaint that limited class membership to citizens of any state. The case proceeded for 2 years and went through discovery, and then Ms. Dantzel moved the state court to certify a class, and at that time she updated her class definition to come more in line with what the parties learned in discovery about how Groupon software worked. And that class definition still had a close connection to Illinois because that's what Groupon software requested, was Illinois photos taken at Illinois businesses to advertise those businesses. Now, when presented with that class definition, Groupon removed the case to the district court, but in its notice of removal, and at no time since, has it provided any affirmative allegations as to the presence of any minimally diverse class plaintiffs. All it's gestured towards is the possibility of minimal diversity. And under this court's precedent and the requirements of the Class Action Fairness Act, that's just not enough for this court or the district court to maintain subject matter jurisdiction over.
You initially conceded when you moved to remand that the parties were minimally diverse. What impact should that have?
I think it has no impact for the simple reason that the parties cannot confer subject matter jurisdiction on the court by agreement. One case that we cite primarily in our brief is the Toulon versus Continental Casualty case. And if you go back over that record, you'll note that in that case, that was one where the plaintiff originally filed in federal court, and the parties there also had an agreement in front of the district court that there was subject matter jurisdiction and the parties were minimally diverse, but that didn't affect this court's decision about whether or not there was jurisdiction in any way.
It seems like you would agree here that there certainly is a reasonable probability, though, that some proposed class member is minimally diverse, given the breadth of the class here.
Well, sure. A couple points to that, Your Honor. So, first of all, we've always agreed that it's possible that there are minimally diverse class plaintiffs here. The concession that Your Honor just referenced and Groupon cites in its opposition papers, I think it goes to that. It's that both at the time the case was originally filed with a residency limitation and at the time that class certification was moved for with this effective practical limitation, there were the possibility of minimally diverse class plaintiffs, sure, they exist. When we say that also in our opening brief with this court. But possibilities aren't enough. And again, I'll go back to the Toulon case, which I think is very on point here. In Toulon, again, the plaintiff filed the case in federal court. There were allegations in the complaint that said, all right, this case is about these insurance policies that the defendant sold to class plaintiffs across the country. They were authorized to be sold in 32 different states. It came out that there were 170,000 some policies at issue. And the plaintiff concluded from those facts, similar to what Groupon concludes here, that there are minimally diverse plaintiffs. But this court found that that wasn't enough, and it wasn't until the defendant came forward with actual diverse class plaintiffs that this court found that, yes, it has jurisdiction over the case.
If your assertion is correct, could Groupon cure that deficiency here by supplementing the record with one plaintiff who is minimally diverse?
Sure. I mean, the answer to that question is, who knows? I mean, in their papers, they say they don't have any evidence of it, but they do have, they could seek leave to supplement the record or file amended jurisdictional facts. This court has discretion to allow that kind of amendment. There was already an order from this court directed at
Correct.
Groupon's jurisdictional statement pointing out that it wasn't enough. They didn't come forward with any new evidence other than the fact that their software wasn't able to exclude non-citizens of Illinois when they collected info from, you know, members of this putative class. And so, to Your Honor's questions, it's possible. I don't know if they're going to be able to. And I think that brings up another interesting point that The district court in particular requested more briefing on, and Groupon raises briefly in its opposition papers, and that is if the parties go to the step of conducting additional jurisdictional discovery, whether that's before this court or whether it's on remand to the district court, and Groupon is able to meet its burden of identifying one minimally diverse class plaintiff that's a citizen of a state other than Illinois or Delaware, then Ms. Dansell has some options. One, she can raise a factual challenge if she wants to, and two, she can conduct her own jurisdictional discovery to show that, just like in the In Re Sprint Nextel case that was also in front of this court, that remand is going to be required in any event under the Class Action Fairness Act's local controversy exception because, again, of this the close connection that this case has to Illinois. And to that end, I also think it's worth pointing out that Groupon states in its brief over and over again that it's delusional to think that perhaps this class consists entirely of Illinois citizens. But I don't think it's delusional at all. It's entirely possible because, again, if we look at the facts of this case and the
way— You think it's entirely possible that there isn't one minimally diverse plaintiff whose photograph was taken on Instagram and posted on Groupon with a potentially worldwide class?
I think there's a distraction with the worldwide class issue. To directly answer your question—
Let's say it's a nationwide class.
Sure.
With the use of Instagram, you think it's possible that there is not a minimally diverse plaintiff here?
I'll go back to how I answered your first question, Your Honor. I agree that it's possible that there's a minimally diverse class plaintiff here, but Groupon hasn't identified one. But is it also possible that there isn't? I think that's true. And I think one place it's easy to get distracted is Groupon points to that Instagram is accessible worldwide and nationwide, right? It received a lot of photos as it put the software into operation. But it's important to remember what photos those were, right? They were all photos taken at local Illinois businesses to advertise those businesses. The one example that we put in our reply brief is a series of photos that Groupon received that were taken at a haunted house in Elgin, Illinois. Is it possible that someone from Wisconsin came to that haunted house, took a picture, posted it to their Instagram profile, and that got swept up in this advertising scheme? Sure. Is it likely? I wouldn't say so. But the point at this juncture is that this court has said in the Sprint Nextel case that guesswork about jurisdictional facts just isn't sufficient to carry a party's burden under the Class Action Fairness Act, whether that's establishing original jurisdiction under CAFA or establishing that the local controversy exception would require remand, which, as I stated before, will be the case here if the parties do go forward with jurisdictional discovery.
The discussion we've been having has been in terms of possibility.
Sure.
Your answers remain the same if the key term is plausibility?
I think, for my part, I think there's a bit of a fuzzy line between possibility and plausibility, but I think when we look at this court's precedent, when we look at Talon, and then we look at what Groupon has alleged here, the facts in Talon, the allegations that issued there were much stronger here to give rise to a plausible inference of a minimally diverse class plaintiff.
So it is plausible that a non-Illinois, non-Delaware citizen visiting Chicago posted and tagged an Instagram photo at a business that ran a Groupon deal?
I don't know that I would agree that it's plausible, Your Honor. I do agree that it's possible, but again, and under this court's precedent, it's Groupon's burden to make that allegation. They haven't made the allegation here, so there's just nothing for this court to hang its jurisdictional hat on and allow the case to go forward and reach the merits of this appeal.
Is the class limited to Groupon deals in Illinois, though? It seemed that the class was broad enough that it applied to all Groupon deals, not just those in Illinois.
No, Your Honor, it is Illinois. It's photos.
Just Illinois, okay.
Right, so the way the class definition reads, it's about photos and other Instagram content that Groupon used to advertise Illinois businesses.
Okay.
And those are Illinois deals, and therefore there's that connection again to Illinois. Turning over to the substantive side of this appeal, I think there's really two ways to look at the district court's order denying class certification, and either way, there was an abuse of discretion. So the first has to do with the mechanics of the district court's decision. Under this court's precedent in Bell, Costello, and the Supreme Court's ruling in Amgen, it's clear that what the district court is required to do at class certification is to look at the plaintiff's legal theory and make a determination as to whether that legal theory is supported by common evidence. The merits of that legal theory are just off the table at class certification. So to the extent a district court denies class certification by either rejecting a theory outright or by pointing to other theories under which individual evidence might be required, that's an abuse of discretion. In Costello, I think there's a pretty good fact pattern that works in here. There, the district court denied class certification because the plaintiffs in that case wanted to proceed on a class basis under one of three prongs in an Illinois Wage Act. The district court pointed out that, well, if the plaintiffs fail under that prong one, individual plaintiffs still might be able to proceed under prongs one or prongs two, which would require individualized evidence, and refuse to certify for that reason. But this court looked at that decision, said, no, what the district court has to do is to examine the plaintiff's legal theory, determine whether it's supported by common evidence, and if it is, the class should be certified, even if failure on that theory might result in individual cases later. The point being that proceeding on a class basis on the plaintiff's theory will have the efficiencies that underlie Rule 23.
If you proceeded on the plaintiff's theory of identifying just through the username categorically,
right,
and you lost at summary judgment on that,
right,
would the individual plaintiffs still be able to pursue their individual cases here on their individual identity?
I think the answer is yes. And
then how can you proceed under Amgen with the class question here?
I think Bell answers that directly. So in Bell, there was the plaintiff's class theory dependent on proof of an unofficial overtime policy. The court noted that if the plaintiffs succeed in that theory, everyone would win all at once. If they failed on that theory, all the class plaintiffs would fail on that theory all at once, and the defendant wouldn't face that same legal theory again and again and again, even if, the court noted, individual cases were still brought. And so contrast that to the situation at issue here, right? The district court essentially denied Ms. Dansell's class litigation theory on the merits at class certification instead of certifying and then deciding that as to all the class members later. So if this court didn't reverse and the case went forward individually, then every single member of the class could, again, bring that same username theory that Ms. Dansell went forward on, and other judges would have to decide, okay, do I think that falls under the IRPA's definition of identity or it doesn't? There could even be subsequent class claims potentially on that same issue. But that wouldn't happen if this court followed the precedent set by Bell and Costello, which says that, no, if the theory is supported by common evidence, it should be certified as a class, a merits decision can be reached, and then there would be a binding judgment on those class members in their individual claims, should any be followed, or should any follow the case. And then apart from this issue about whether or not the district court inappropriately addressed the merits of Ms. Dansell's claim, I also think that to the extent it was allowed to address that claim, its analysis isn't supported by the text or purpose of the Illinois Right of Publicity Act. The district court, like Groupon here in its opposition, what it effectively imposed was a requirement that an average viewer or listener of, well, I guess it would be viewer here of Groupon's website, would actually know the individuals behind the usernames or behind the photos. And that's not something that the IRPA requires. All the IRPA requires is that...
Was it that they would actually know that particular individual, or that they would be able to identify through the evidence presented at trial that it was that particular individual?
I think it's more the...
It seemed like the latter.
The
like
latter,
it wouldn't have to be a Michael Jordan figure who everyone would identify. It could be a Jane Doe as long as the evidence linked up to establish that that was Jane Doe's identity.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think it's helpful here to look to try and think about what a trial would look like, and then assuming it was a trial on a class basis, what the claims process might look like, right? So Ms. Dansell would go before a jury. She would say, this was my username, the Meow Christine username. I was the only person that used that username at the time that it appeared in Groupon's advertising. Based on how Instagram's registration process worked, there can be only one username associated with one individual. And based on that evidence alone, a jury could conclude that, yes, a reasonable viewer of the website would understand those facts. And that because that's Ms. Dansell's username, that's not in contest here, she's proven identity. Then when it came time to for class members to prove their claims, they could just submit an affidavit swearing under penalty of perjury that, yes, I controlled username X at the time that Groupon used it in advertising. And because of this uniqueness, this one-to-one relationship between usernames and users, there's no other evidence that's needed to prove up a class member's claim. And the content of each of those usernames just doesn't matter. All that does matter for the purposes of the IRPA, for these usernames to be identifying attributes, is that they are unique, much like a signature or a voice.
But how do you respond to her response during the deposition that it could be someone that's not her? I mean, you've got the Philly G's Meow Christine, and you've got the ukulele playing Meow Christine. How does the identity analysis factor into that?
Sure. So I don't think, so one thing that Groupon pointed out, right, was that people don't generally know Christine Dansell by her Instagram username on a day-to-day basis. But I think what people generally recognize is how usernames work, right? Everyone has an email address. Everyone that's going to be viewing Groupon's website, the average viewer of Groupon's website, is going to have an email address. And everyone understands that when someone receives an email coming from my email address, they understand that that's an email coming from one distinct person. You know, it's a username. It's a unique username. And so, again, all that Ms. Dansell has to show to prevail under the IRPA is that I controlled this username at the time it was used by Groupon in its advertising. And that's it. There's no additional requirements that, oh, and by the way, my friends know me as Meow Christine. That would be a subjective standard, which is not something that the IRPA looks at. Rather, she just has to establish the relationship, and that's why class proceedings were appropriate here.
Do you want to reserve the rest of your time?
I will. Thank you, Your Honor.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Tomasson. Ms. Coberly.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'll start with jurisdiction because that's where my colleague started. There's no real issue presented here as to the court's jurisdiction. A jurisdictional argument would require arguing that there is no minimal diversity in this case, but the plaintiff has conceded that, and more importantly, the plaintiff has conceded the facts underlying that question. I certainly agree that the parties can't create jurisdiction through concession. But a party, and particularly a plaintiff who crafted a class definition and is the proponent of the class, can make concessions, factual concessions, about who is and who is not in the class that they are propounding.
Ms. Coberly, if we asked you to supplement the record to identify a plaintiff whose citizenship is not Illinois or Delaware, could you do that?
Not right now, no. Of course, the remedy, if there really were a jurisdictional problem, would be a remand to the district court. And that would be appropriate simply because the issue of citizenship wasn't contested in the district court. So we would need the opportunity to put on evidence to challenge what the plaintiffs have contested. And this court's cases make clear that we don't have an evidentiary burden unless the plaintiffs contest the fact. And we could go back and hire a private investigator or something like that and identify we'd need to find a username that was actually the name, right? So as I'll get to in a moment, usernames are often fictitious. They're often designed to obscure the identity of the person using the username. So you can't just look at the username and know who it is. And that's, of course, the point we're making on the class certification issue. But could we identify a specific human and hire a private investigator and figure out whether they were citizens? Yes, we could do that, and we would do it on remand. My point before this court is that would be a not an effective use of judicial resources, because here the plaintiff has conceded the fact, not just the jurisdictional issue, but the fact that the class may include non-Illinois residents. In the state court, in the class certification motion, which we cited in our notice of removal in paragraph 18, the plaintiff can acknowledge the fact, quoting, the fact that the class and the subclass may include non-Illinois residents. In the district court, in support of her motion to remand, in her brief, she said, to be clear, the plaintiff does not contest that CAFA's requirement of minimal diversity is satisfied. In the reply supporting the motion to remand, the plaintiff wrote, students at Illinois colleges and military personnel stationed in the state are just two examples of groups likely to contain class members who are not also Illinois citizens. And on appeal, you know, you heard my colleague say he didn't want to concede that it was probable or anything other than possible that the class included a non-Illinois resident. But in his appeal brief, he wrote, it's likely that at least some Instagram content giving rise to class membership was posted to Instagram by non-Illinois citizens, such as college students or members of the military. And that doesn't even account for tourists or people from just over the border. We've got cities in Illinois that span state borders, St. Louis, Beloit, East Chicago, where if there's a business in those states on the Illinois side, it's as the plaintiff concedes, likely that there would be people posting Instagram content that's geolocated to those locations, even if they themselves are from outside the state.
Corporally, how do we get around Miller versus Southwest Airlines, the recent case from this circuit, where the court pointed out that it was pretty obvious they could meet minimal diversity, but they hadn't alleged, for some reason, the court says, they hadn't alleged it in the notice of removal, but the court didn't need to worry about it or send it back to the district court to make that determination because they ultimately concluded there was federal question jurisdiction.
Because here the underlying fact is conceded. That's the difference. So it's not just a question of quality of allegations. Here the plaintiff, the proponent of the class, the drafter of the class definition, concedes that it is likely that the class includes people who are not citizens of Illinois. And that's what distinguishes the case. Of course, in Miller, the court concluded that the remedy, if there is a problem, is to send it back to the district court.
Right.
But that's just not necessary here because the underlying fact is conceded. So the other issues that were raised on appeal relating to jurisdiction aren't jurisdictional issues at all. They are process issues, and they aren't appropriate in a 23F appeal, which is why it was striking to see them so prominently in the brief when they were not in the petition for review under 23F. So turning to the class certification issue itself, the district court here did exactly what this court's cases require. It looked at the legal elements of a claim under the Illinois Right of Publicity Act and evaluated whether those elements could be satisfied using common proof. The question under the statute, just looking at its plain language, is whether the attribute in question, here that would be the username, serves to identify the specific human being behind that username to an ordinary and reasonable viewer. And the answer to that question is no, you cannot evaluate that question based on common evidence.
And that's you're what the not saying, just to clarify what came up before, you're not saying that that individual has to be a Michael Jordan type figure
No.
or some person who's well known.
No.
You just have to be able to link it up that it is that particular individual, whether it's Jane Doe or it's somebody else.
Correct. And a specific human, not just any human, but a specific human.
Because so, it says that individual
correct,
in the statute.
Exactly. And it uses that phrase, that individual,
yes.
Both in the provision, the definition of individual, I'm sorry, both in the definition of identity and in the definition of name. So we are talking about some attribute that identifies a specific human being. Now I read in Denzel's reply brief, she tries to suggest that it's enough that we can assume that a human being was behind a username. And that's not what the statute says. It says that individual, a specific human being. And by the way, it's not even clear that that a human being is behind a username at all. And that's part of why the court denied class certification. Usernames.
Why couldn't that be addressed through affidavits, as counsel proposed?
Because it goes to the elements of the claim. It's not just a matter of damages. It's not. It's it goes to the fundamental issue. The whether a username identifies a specific human being is a factual issue. And of course it could. It could identify a specific human. Some usernames are names, are the same name that you would use in your ordinary life. Sometimes usernames are famous people. Sometimes they are not. Sometimes it would, my username could be Linda Coberly, and then that might identify me. But usernames might also be fictitious. They might be specific. In the evidence, there was a lot of evidence in the record on this issue. Usernames may be fictitious, specifically designed to obscure the identity of the specific human being. Usernames can be used anonymously. Instagram says so. In fact, to open an account on Instagram, all you have to do is provide an email address. Well, you can have a fake email address too. You need to provide a name and email address, and that's it, nothing else. You can use Instagram anonymously. The owner of a username in Instagram may not be a natural person at all. It could be a business, could be a team or an organization, could be a Russian bot. There are lots of different ways that this can happen. The most we can say is that a username identifies an Instagram account for a period of time, because of course you can change your username. But a username identifies an Instagram and an Instagram account. And an Instagram account doesn't have a right of publicity under the Illinois statute. Only a natural person, a specific natural person, has that right. Now, again, is it possible that a username could identify a specific person? Of course. But it's an individual issue. It will require a trial. It would require specific evidence about that username, about the person, etc. It can't be resolved on a class-wide basis, and that's the basis for the judge's decision denying class certification. This identification piece is very critical given the purpose of a right of publicity statute like the one in Illinois, and that is that the underlying issue is to protect people from a use of their identity that creates the impression that that particular human being endorses or appears to endorse a product. So if Meow Christine doesn't identify a specific human, and we submit it doesn't, there's no risk that anyone would believe that Christine Denzel endorsed Philly G's. It could be Philly, also, we're talking about a class that's defined so broadly that there might have been a username that was actually Philly G's in disguise to advocate for its own or endorse its own product. Might have been a baseball team who had an event at Philly G's and posted content that was geolocated to Philly G's, and that baseball team could have a username. They're all different possibilities. It simply can't be resolved on a class-wide basis. I also want to point out, as we've noted, that there are other problems with class certification in this case. The other elements of class certification, including commercial use and consent, are things that the court did not reach but would need to before certifying the class here. The identity element is simply one piece, and the court correctly concluded that that element of a claim under the Right of Publicity Act could not be resolved on a class-wide basis. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Coberly. We'll now go back to Mr. Tomasin for your rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just two quick points. On the jurisdictional discussion Your Honors had with counsel, her main point was that the concession here wasn't it wasn't a legal concession that the court has subject matter jurisdiction. It was a factual concession. And I think it's important here to look what kind of factual concessions are possible in this case. And I think that's evident in Groupon's notice of removal, because as counsel said, standing up here a second ago, all Groupon stated was that it was possible or likely or undoubtable that class plaintiffs exist. And Ms. Denzel can agree that's the case, but even if that's true, that only means it's possible, it's likely. The district court
does it mean it's plausible to go back to Judge Brennan's?
I don't think it's plausible. I do think it's possible.
How is it possible even, but not plausible?
Okay. Even if
because
it
that's
is,
what Rule 8 requires of the plausibility.
Right.
Allegation.
And I think, Your Honor,
I know why you're pushing back on that.
Sure. Even if it is plausible, this court requires more. In Toulon, this court said that you just have to identify the state of citizenship of at least one minimally diverse party. The issue came up again in Miller, as Your Honor just pointed, and had Groupon alleged in their notice of removal or anywhere else, for example, that this class includes at least one person from the state of that's a citizen of the state of Wisconsin, and Ms. Dantzel agreed to that fact, then I agree that there would be no issue here. There, the parties, the allegations would be enough to satisfy this court's requirement for minimal diversity. But we don't have anything like that here, so I don't think the court can find that it has subject matter jurisdiction at this point. And that all just, again, it goes back to Sprint Nextel's. Guesswork is not enough. The second point I just wanted to bring up is Groupon here, in response to Your Honor's question, stated that no, it's not saying that you need to be a celebrity to maintain a claim under the IRPA, but that's the effect of their argument. Under Groupon's worldview, and I think Judge Shaw's worldview from Dabrowski and the district court's worldview as well, the only individuals that can possibly maintain a claim under the IRPA, whether it's for usernames, names, voices, signatures, anything else, are those individuals who would be generally recognized by the public at large, Morgan Freeman's voice or Johnny Carson's voice, to use two examples from Groupon's brief. But that was not the point of enacting the IRPA, which this court held in Martin's is broad. It categorically presents certain types of information and then also protects other types of information like Instagram usernames that have this one-to-one relationship between identifier, the attributes that are protected, and individuals. And that's why this case should go forward on a class basis.
Thank you, Mr. Tomasin. Thank you, Ms. Coberly. The case will be taken under advisement.